Well, I think it was then that we discovered that everything isn't fair. I always had a belief that if you keep doing things right, you will get lucky. I simply couldn't accept that decision. It was totally ridiculous.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Michael Betton.
I've always been a fan of cricket, and I was at boarding school for a while, and I worked out how you could have the earphone cable down inside my sleeve listening to the cricket when I was meant to be paying attention in lessons. And I did get caught because the lead came out a bit too quickly. And I had this remarkably cool school teacher who said, "Could you just tell us what the score is, please? And then you better turn it off." And never said anything more about it. But, you know, I was all parts of radio, you know, the early days of Radio 1, Radio 2, Pirate Radio, Radio Luxembourg.
Around the world and to the outermost limits of the 28 known galaxies.
I just was fascinated by communicating in that way. Radio was much more then than it is now, absolutely one to many. So the idea of somebody sitting in Luxembourg talking to the UK in the evening was just fascinating, and I loved the music. When I was still at school, I was desperate to work on the radio. Radio Orwell had just launched. I'd got some experience running a show on the local hospital radio. I persuaded my headmaster to spend some money allowing me to put together a radio station at the school, so got a fully equipped studio and distributed around all the common rooms. So before I went to university, I was already working at a fairly new Radio Orwell in those days, and really knew it was what I wanted to do.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, October the 28th, 1975. For the first time, welcome to Radio Orwell.
In town and village, Anglia way, the nicest things happen to make your day. On Radio Orwell Stereo.
I first did some work at Radio Orwell when I was 15, which was 1977. The original managing director was Donald Brooks, who was then superseded by David Cox. And David Cox is still running Anglia Radio now, with various bits in between. But a presentation team of people like Keith Rogers, Harry Rowell, Andy Archer, Patrick Ead was there. Later on, Rob Chandler.
Keith Rogers, Radio Orwell.
Yes, and a very good morning for me, Keith Rogers. I don't want to say very much today because I'm shaking like a proverbial.
A whole range of names and some now well-known newsreaders. Tim Ewart was there as head of news.
Good morning, this is Tim Ewart with Radio Orwell News. East Anglia has its first local radio station. After months
David
of work
Willis,
on
who's the international correspondent for the BBC, he worked there with me at Radio Orwell in the early days, and remarkable just how many people went on to other jobs, some within TV, some within the radio industry. I got in through the door saying I'd help on the sports programme on Saturday afternoon, but I persuaded them they ought to do a programme for teenagers and that it really ought to be presented by a teenager, so I got the gig. It was the same old thing. You volunteered to do the things that probably a good idea if you got paid for, because otherwise you just got asked to do things that were pointless, but nobody else wanted to do. So at Radio Orwell, the thing that gave me a lot of money, still don't understand to this day, was actually recording the reports from the Ipswich Witches, the local speedway team. Now, we used to put those reports out after the 9 and 10 o'clock news. Trouble is they couldn't be live because you can't hear anything when the race is in order. So somebody needed to be there to press the button on the cart for the report at about 10:02 and carry it down to the studio and play it out and then edit it so that there was a report for the next morning. You got quite well paid for that, so I used to do that on a regular basis. And slowly but surely you found a way of getting yourself in and making yourself indispensable.
Oh, well. Stereo.
97.1.
University was a part-time thing for me. Every holiday, every vacation, I was back. My vacations used to coincide quite nicely with presenters going on holiday, so I did the fill-in shifts. So I presented every programme on Radio Warwell at some time or the other. I loved presenting, but I always wanted to plan how a radio station worked, how it went together. And I think I was pretty clear early on that although I was good enough to be a presenter on a fill-in basis, I was never going to have a long-term career as a presenter. I didn't really want to. I dreamt of being a programme manager. I used to plan out schedules of what the perfect radio station would be like. And, you know, over time, I was able to do more of that. I'd worked on and off all the way with Radio Orwell, and they created a so-called management trainee position for me. And I did that for a while, and then they reorganised what was a tiny station in Bury St Edmunds and asked me if I'd like to sort of make that work on a day-to-day basis. And I did that for a while. I was enjoying things. And then Radio Victory lost its licence to Ocean Sound.
The time is 11:59. Radio Victory has approximately 1.5 minutes left to live. And when you hear the chimes coming from the Portsmouth Guildhall clock, the time will be 12 midday.
And there was an advertisement in broadcast for programme controller. And my wife, Maggie, said, you ought to apply for that. I said, don't be so ridiculous. They'll be looking for somebody really experienced to do this. I'm only 24. Not a chance. And, you know, all the big beasts were being lined up for this job. And I applied. I was interviewed, to my great shock and all of my colleagues. Some of them were kind to say otherwise, but I think nobody could really understand that I'd get that job. I left Suffolk to go down to the South Coast. Hardly knew the South Coast at the time, but what a wonderful opportunity.
Radio Victory has decided to cease broadcasting in advance of the expiry date of its local radio franchise. From mid-October, the independent local radio service for Portsmouth and Southampton will be provided by a new company, Ocean Sound.
Radio Victory went off the air quite quickly after it lost its licence. So there'd been a very badly put together IBA tape on the old Radio Victory frequency. We had a phenomenal new transmitter on the Isle of Wight at Chilliton Down, and a real vision for how to make a radio station work. The radio station wasn't in Portsmouth or Southampton. It was in a crinkly box in Fareham. And I suppose it was from then on I realised that radio was about what you broadcast and not how you do it. We were told, it's not going to work. You're not in either one of the two key cities. And of course it worked wonderfully. It was separate programming some of the day for each of the two areas. So going through tapes, recruiting 8 presenters and 6 journalists for this new station, when all we had was a tiny office above a takeaway, I think, or maybe a off license in Southampton. Everything was coming to shape in your mind with nothing physical to see at all. And again, that's the perfect thing about radio. You can have all the dreams with nothing. You just have to then find how to put it together. And I was lucky enough to choose a wonderful bunch of people to work with. And again, names that are still around or doing things in the industry came in those years that I was at Ocean Sound. But it was wonderfully exciting. No commercial radio in Southampton, just Radio Solent. And being able at that stage, I think, to have a really clear vision.
This is Ocean Sound. This is the birth of a radio station.
The chairman of Ocean Sound, Philip Pollock.
Ocean Sound, 24 hours a day.
I think happily there was enough time between the two to make people realise that Victory had gone. It wasn't Ocean Sound's fault that they'd gone. It was the regulator's decision. We recruited some of the Victory presenters and journalists, so there was some continuity. And I think that by the time we launched, people had realised how much they valued Radio Victory, but what they really realised is how much they valued commercial radio for the area, and they were keen to get back on.
And I just have to say good morning and welcome to Britain's newest independent radio station, Ocean Sound. From now on, we'll be with you 24 hours a day.
The IBA were a little, my goodness, I had to push them hard, but they were a little bit less keen to have, you know, arts programme on Wednesday, jazz programme on Thursday, and we were able to do quite a few radical things and really understand that we needed presenters who knew the areas they were broadcasting to and communicated with the people they were talking to, rather than getting carried away on voyages of fantasy. We had thought that we wouldn't have to broadcast overnight. We had some piece of kit that was going to do the sustaining service. It was very similar to the old 8-track stereo cartridges. And then somebody wanted to buy some ads overnight, and I thought, well, that should be cheaper to have a presenter. So, in fact, we recruited Alex Dyke to be our overnight presenter, who, through various points at Isle of Wight Radio, I think still at BBC Radio Solent. It was less complicated than it is now. People are sometimes surprised when I say that. Yes, you had to load up carts. We were still using discs. We weren't straight to CDs. It was all quite mechanical, but actually very simple. I used to sit down with presenters and discuss shows, used to do the logging tapes, all those sort of things. But I don't think we were so tied down by the commercial considerations of having to get this mention in here and that credit there. You played the breaks, you made sure you played the breaks correctly. And the rest of what you did was about trying to do what was going to maximise audience and be right for your listeners. That's not quite possible anymore. I'm sure if we hadn't made the changes, commercial radio wouldn't still be here, because that was a model that wouldn't have stood the test of time. But I do remember that your conversation with the sales team was how big an audience you could get. And it didn't revolve around some of what can be tedious details of 101 different requirements to meet the commercial needs of our customers. That's great. We've increased commercial revenues fantastically, but I do remember the extra freedom that you had being program controller or whatever they were called in those days, of really just worrying about the output as long as you played the ads right.
Hello again and welcome live from Ryde on the Isle of Wight. This is Jean-Paul Hansford with another 4 hours of island news, music, features and guests in the Isle of Wight programme.
Well, I got a lot of people to do an awful lot of work for me, so I guess I must have been doing it okay. Truth is, of course, I was scared stiff and almost everybody was older than me. I was quite direct, quite demanding and expected people to come with me. I've definitely changed, but I think if you're put in charge of a lot of people at quite a young age, you can't be friends with them all. It doesn't work. So I was, you know, I was just always reflected on what we were broadcasting, and I was interested in whether we were doing it well or not. I was keen to make sure there was a good team atmosphere and everybody was on the same path and trying to achieve the same thing. But if you're thrown in very young, managing people with big egos and ways of talking people around, you've just got to sort of draw a line and say, no, we're going to do it this way, actually. When Ocean Sound merged with Southern Radio, so that was Brighton, David Lucas became the chief executive of the group, and I was managing director of the Ocean Sound part. with Rory McLeod being managing director of the Southern Sound part. That coincided with 91, 92, radio revenues started to fall, expectations of the merger, which, you know, like so many mergers, doesn't quite work with so many people involved. David left, Rory took over, I stayed for a while. But by the time I left, it was not the radio station I'd created. And whilst it was fine, not something I was proud of, and of course it didn't actually stay in its new form for that long. And some of the groundbreaking things that had been achieved, yeah, they stuck around for a while. But Power FM was... unique is overstating it, but it was right at the beginning of giving listeners a choice. So we took Ocean Sound off the transmitter on the Isle of Wight. We put Ocean Sound on the Winchester relay, which had a good signal in Southampton. And it was a service again, you know, I dreamt up of a piece of paper, and I remember explaining, we're not going to have the news on the hour, we're going to have it at 2 minutes to, so that we're back to the music unlike everybody else. The other reason was that the newsreader could read that bulletin and the other bulletin, and it was much more efficient. But, you know, we had different reasons for different people. So, huge sadness. I'd seen some people really develop wonderfully there, and we'd achieved really good audience figures, and we'd had a fantastically successful launch, and the radio station was operating really well. But once you go over that, you don't really want to go back. And actually, I've never set foot in Sedgensworth since.
From the heart of the New Forest to the fringe of West Sussex, from St Catherine's Point to Winchester and beyond.
Power FM.
I don't think my vision was the same as Rory McLeod had for the new group, and happily I'd agreed with the board I could put in an application for Lincolnshire, and that came up at more or less the right time. I actually left Ocean Sound after having put in the application, but without knowing the result. I think a lot of people might think that was, you know, were you so sure? No, I wasn't. I fully expected that we weren't going to get the licence. And I was actually doing a bit of work for Eddie Veal, helping him with his studio construction work. But, you know, what I really wanted to do was win the licence for Lincolnshire, an area I'd grown up in. And just thought commercial radio really could work here. Whereas everybody else's attitude was, well, it's rural, there's nobody around. We really just ought to add it on to something that already exists and it'll all be fine. I think there were five applicants for the licence, and the applicant that I think most people thought would win was the Radio Trent conglomeration led by Ron Coles. This was the first competitive licence under the radio authority. They were learning how this would all work. The application process was extraordinary. It was about 32 pages. Thou shalt not put in any extra research material, any extra bits of paper. You could only put one single page of A4 about your research for justifying the process. Goodness me, how that changed to the complete reverse. It was very clean, a small document, which I put together on my computer, looks very old-fashioned now, but that basically set out how I thought the radio station could work. And I suppose I listened to people saying, but Lincolnshire's not got enough population, it's too rural, you're not going to make the revenue. We were in difficult times, you're being too ambitious, it's not going to work, but we'll give it a whirl. Of course, they were wrong, we were right, and we won the licence. I've never liked being in big groups of people waiting for results. I was in Eddie Veal's office in Stevenage, working in a separate room. I got the phone call. They told me I got the license. I said, thanks very much. And I got quite a bit of work to do for Eddie Veal, so nobody else knew we'd won it for quite some hours afterwards, which again, if I remember, David said, well, David Vick said, we'll be making an announcement soon. And I said, well, I actually won't be able to tell anybody else till this evening, so could you wait? I'm not sure he was desperately thrilled about that, but I was literally a one-man band. I'd got my shareholders together, but there was, other than our chairman at Navid Hudson Davis, nobody else had been involved in putting the license together. I'd had some help from Claire Carson, who was our initial news editor, so she knew fairly quickly. But there wasn't a great big bunch of people to tell we'd been successful, because there simply wasn't a great big bunch of people. The most significant thing for Lynx FM's success revolves around the definition of Lincolnshire. When the radio station was advertised, Lincolnshire only went as far as a line between Grimsby and Scunthorpe and Lincoln. North East Lincolnshire and North Lincolnshire didn't exist at that stage. They'd been taken out of Lincolnshire and put into Humberside. Having grown up in the Lincolnshire world, the thought that Grimsby or Scunthorpe weren't in Lincolnshire was an anathema. It was nonsense. The original advertisement in those days, it told you frequency and power and restrictions. It was from Belmont, which is, I think, still the tallest structure in Europe. It's a fantastic transmitting mast. And the assumption was that we'd use the antenna for BBC Radio Lincolnshire. BBC Radio Lincolnshire had been designed to complement BBC Radio Humberside and not cover Grimsby and Scunthorpe, and they had a directional antenna. What I discovered after we won the licence was that the antenna was not suitable for our frequency. So I was being told by what was then NTL, you need a new antenna. And I said, okay, so what would you suggest? I said, well, we'll just build you another dipole. I said, but we've got omnidirectional. There's no restriction. What could you do? I said, oh, we could build you a four-panel antenna so you get perfect power in all directions. I thought, well, that's what we better do. So I rang David Vick and I said, look, we can't use BBC Radio Lincoln's antenna, which is pity. We're going to have our own antenna built. I've looked at the advertisement. It says omnidirectional. You're fine with that? And he said, yeah, that's fine. I checked his maps. That's fine. So we went ahead and had the antenna built that way.
This is a test transmission from Lynx FM on 102.2.
Test transmissions came on about 4 weeks before we launched. And, of course, we covered everywhere. You could hear us in Oxford. There was no 102.2 being used in Birmingham. So it was really clear frequency. We went everywhere from one of the best masts in the country. A few days afterwards, I got a call from Radio Authority saying, you're getting much more coverage than we intended. Can you turn it down a bit? And I said, no. And thanks to that, we got far more coverage than was ever envisaged. Ironically, therefore, covered the whole of Lincolnshire. And when there was the local boundary review and recreated Lincolnshire, we, of course, were the only station that covered all of Lincolnshire on a local basis. That, if you like, bit of luck and digging our heels in, that's why we've been so successful. But not covering all of Lincolnshire would be a nonsense.
You're listening to a test transmission from Lynx FM, the new independent commercial radio station.
Well, I needed £500,000. And with help of lawyers, I put together a prospectus. We're still the company's lawyers now, a lot bigger than they used to be. I persuaded a few of the directors that I'd lined up to put some money in. But then literally I roped round and knocked on doors in Lincolnshire until I'd raised enough cash. most of those shareholders are still with us now.
At last, the wait is over. Welcome to Lynx FM 102.2. It's Sunday the 1st of March 1992. I'm Nick Jackson until 12 o'clock midday today. Right now, it's 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. The wait is over, your brand new 24-hour local radio station serving historic Lincolnshire and South Humberside on 102.2.
Day one, Sunday the 1st of March 1992. David Lloyd was the senior programmer. We put together, I think, a great team. It was the culmination of an awful lot of things. It always then seemed, you know, there's a little bit of a wing and a prayer. We were editing commercials and running round sorting things at the last moment. But you just kind of felt it was all coming together. The building worked, the team were all enthusiastic. We'd got some reasonable sales. It all reached a crescendo perfectly on the day. I had to persuade David to play a track that he wasn't really expecting to be asked as the final piece of music in the test transmissions. But having launched Ocean Sound with the final piece of music being the arrival of the Queen of Sheba, we did the same, and it kind of worked. Very exciting, but a very quick realisation, which I think had dawned on me with Ocean Sound and the various stations we launched there. Actually, the launch really isn't that important. It's how good you are day in, day out, afterwards. And actually, I've never been to another radio station launch. Every radio station that the Lynx FM group has started, I've not been there because I don't want to forget the experience of launching Ocean Sound. I don't want to forget the experience of launching Lynx FM. But actually, what's important is what you do day in, day out afterwards. And of course, the more senior you get, the more in the way you are when actually people are trying to get on with broadcasting rather than having a party.
Today we're in the Lynx FM British Gas Kitchen, because it's Tuesday afternoon. Sally Elkington's here as well, and I can hear that sizzling sound, Sally. What are we doing this week?
Right, we're on mince this week.
I decided early on that you need various experts to advise you. I needed auditors to help me put the prospectus together, and I needed lawyers. I was pretty clear what I wanted them to do. Besides that, to be honest, I just got on with it. This was pre-internet, so you were ordering books on company law and how do I do it? How do I issue shares? Bank was interesting, you know. Oh, you're raising cash. It's great. We'll help you. Happy to run a current account. You want to borrow anything? Not a chance. It really was feeling your way along, because I didn't have business experts, and we ended up with some people had a lot of experience on the board, but that wasn't at the time putting the application in, nor the early months. I must have got lucky, because I didn't make too many mistakes, but it really was just a matter of having to do it yourself.
From the Humber to the Wash, 102.2, this is Lynx FM.
We were lucky with our national sales, because I was able to persuade what was then Capital Radio that they should sell our national advertising, and doing that spawned media sales and marketing, which did really well for us until they decided they needed to close it down so that they could purchase Virgin Radio, which they weren't allowed to, which was ironic. But we were able to achieve quite quickly some national revenue. But local revenue was very difficult. Lincoln was quite old-fashioned in 1992, and I remember being told there are certain people you have to be in with, otherwise you won't succeed. So you needed to be in with the Echo, you needed to be on good terms with the Cathedral and also the Lincoln Co-op. I ignored all of that and therefore was told that we'd probably be out of business in 6 months, and we very nearly were. We were losing money in the first few months, And it wasn't until the latter part of 1992, the beginning of 1993, that we were making profits. And it was very much finding a way to, you know, borrow an extra couple of £1,000, or thinking, are we going to be able to meet all these bills? And I think that probably put me in very good stead, and the company in very good stead. Because if you can manage in really difficult times and things get better, suddenly you do rather well. So both with Ocean Sound and with Lynx FM, another big benefit we had was launching when it was blooming tough, because you were really focused on thinking, I've got things that matter here. I'm employing people. I've persuaded them to leave other jobs. I must be able to pay their wages, but I'm not going to go and do something silly that's going to put at risk what we're doing. We're not going to be overambitious. You could have lost everything. When we did manage to persuade the bank to lend us money, I had to provide guarantees. It never got to the stage of saying, you know, everything would go, but there would have been no income. I would have dragged my family up from the South Coast for this mad hat idea of running a radio station in rural Lincolnshire. And yes, I was nervous, but I always had a belief that if you keep doing things right, you will get lucky. And I think we did.
The Lynx FM Top 30 chart brings you all the new hits first every Saturday at 6 o'clock. This is Edward Breton. The biggest selling 7-inch, 12-inch CD and cassette singles across the county are played back to back.
Always dangerous to have expectations on reach. With an area as big as Lincolnshire, it takes time to grow. I'd been used to figures in the 30s with Radio Orwell and with Ocean Sound. And I think when we got our first radar, I think it was 19%. But you kind of thought, that's from nowhere, with a minuscule marketing budget against national services, which in those days Radio 1 was still really dominant, and Radio 2 too, and BBC local radio was towards the top of the pile in performance. So we were thrilled with that, but really the most important thing was making sure we were getting enough revenue in to finance the cost of operating.
The latest forecast, sponsored by Fascino Windows, Lincolnshire.
We applied for the re-advertised licence in Leicester. Leicester Sound gone through a number of difficulties. Before then, it wasn't, we felt, a radio station as fully embedded in the life of Leicester and Leicestershire as it should be. These licences came up for advertisement, so we thought we'd apply. We did. We put in what I think was a really compelling application. And I think it was then that we discovered that everything isn't fair, because the existing incumbent re-won the licence, put me personally under quite a lot of pressure. And if you looked at the applications, it was really difficult to see why we hadn't won, other than the fact we weren't the incumbent and it would really upset the apple cart if there was a change. In those days, the authority didn't give any reasons, so all you got was no. And you thought, right, well, we better move on. I learned in those years something I guess I developed at quite an early age, coming from a big family, which is upset about not winning something should last very, very short period of time. And all the energy, all the emotions that you get from not getting something needs to be used to make your next application better. And I know that one or two of my staff here really worry when I get bad news, because within 24 hours I'm going to be having some new plan of something, if you like, to rebalance it. And it made us determined. We then applied for the
Doncaster re-advertised license, and that was complex because Hallam had two licenses in those days, one for Sheffield and one for Doncaster, and the Doncaster one was re-advertised, and it was the same sort of thing. We put in a really compelling application. We even attended an interview as a result of the application, but it was just a step too far for the authority to not re-award the licence to Hallam. That's when, I guess, I simply couldn't accept that decision. It was totally ridiculous. And after a quick conversation with my board, we decided that we would judicial review the decision. There are all kinds of reasons why you shouldn't judicially review a regulator. We did force them to give reasons, which didn't really stack up for why they'd not awarded us the license. But really, to undo the decision, you had to illustrate some discrepancy in the process. And we weren't able to do that. It's a pity. I think on another day, maybe with a different barrister and a different argument, it could have gone another way. We had the initial seeking leave to appeal, which was turned down, and then we had to go to get that overturned and judge the whole thing in one go. It genuinely could have gone the other way. I don't think things worked for us as well on the day as they should have done. But it was exhilarating in its own funny way because, yeah, I had all these people I'd briefed saying what I'd told them to say, mostly, and I had learned judges considering carefully what they were being asked, and also lots of people ringing me up saying, you know, good luck, I wouldn't be doing it, you must be mad. And I have always quite enjoyed being in a minority of one, and that's a real feeling in a court where you've got the much bigger operators all stacked up, and the radio authority. I mean, the radio authority hired one of the most expensive briefs you possibly could. That said a lot to me because I thought, you must be thinking you might not win this. When I saw how hard the authority were working to defend the case, I thought, I've got a chance here. But I also could see that actually they needed to try very hard to win it. Otherwise, they were unlocking a whole load of problems for themselves. But we did change things, because up till then, the Radio Authority had given no reasons. And if you'll remember after that, reasons crept in as to why things were being awarded. Because I guess they learned from that process that actually their attitude of don't say anything and we'll get away with it simply wouldn't work. And I got the distinct impression at the time that the level of genuine diligence that was being taken to the application process had been a little bit lacking. I don't have direct evidence for that, but all the actions of the Radio Authority during that judicial review process led me to believe that that must be the case, because they were really worried that their decision was going to be undone. They were throwing everything at it, and they were throwing out reasons for why the decision was made that actually seemed to change with the days. But what we were able to extract from it is that we were pretty well de facto winners, even before the application process even started, of the not too far away to be advertised Doncaster licence. And it was that that really spurred us on. We got questions asked in the House of Commons, all kinds of things, to make sure that actually we would have a decent sized Hall of Doncaster Borough advertisement when that came round. So I think if there'd been a promise immediately of a proper amount of power for a Doncaster license in due course, we would have accepted it. It was the thought that we were being, oh, it's okay, you can have this tiny little stick, when clearly that wasn't what people wanted. That's what drove us on. I also learned to, I learned a huge amount from the process. Yes, it cost us a lot of money, but it didn't cost anything like the money I'd been told it would. And the reason for that was because I went to speak to our lawyers. I told them what I was planning to do. They asked me again and again whether I was really sure. I said, right, I don't want to pay any more from this than I have to. I will prepare everything for you. You're not going to have to go searching for things. You'll have every piece of paper, every document you need will all be done without you having too much fuss about it. And that saved us a fortune. I always rationalised the cost of the judicial review as being the price for winning the licence. We've still got one of the smallest licences operating, making money in Rutland. Again, people said, you're applying for a licence for Rutland, you must be mad. Well, it's been a very successful experience for us. We applied for a smaller part of Tracks with Bassett Law. We believed that if we did that, it would make it really clear that when we wanted to be successful with the Doncaster application, we could join the two together. Again, there was a learning curve, I think, for the Radio Authority at the time, because we said, if we win Doncaster, we're going to join up a lot of the programming. And this is the only way we can make it work. And I remember getting comments from the authority saying, well, you probably ought to do a bit more than that. And I thought, well, I've told you it only works if we do it this way, so I can't do more, because otherwise it won't work. And pennies seemed to take rather a long time to drop in those days. Another case of that was when we applied for the Grimsby licence. No other applicants. We worked out very early on we couldn't run a full news service separately for Grimsby. So we said we'll have a journalist in Grimsby and we'll do separate news bulletins but read them from Lincoln. This caused all kinds of upset and worry at the authority because they'd been saying, no, you must be in the area. And I remember having the conversation that went along these lines. I said, well, I have a reporter there. I said, hey, surely you ought to have somebody reading the news at breakfast time there. And I said, actually, nothing new happens at 6 o'clock in the morning in Grimsby or Lincoln for that matter. We're just processing. We could be anywhere. Yes, we need the reporter there. And this was, again, a real struggle for the authority, who simply could not work out that where you were sitting, how you were putting it together, there's always been smoke and mirrors, that it somehow mattered. But we told them we couldn't do it unless we could do it this way. So they reluctantly said yes.
From the news centre, searches are intensifying in the Mediterranean for a passenger plane which has disappeared.
Of course I feel proud. I'm astonished that in March next year we'll have been going for 25 years. It doesn't seem like 25 years. A lot of it seems like only yesterday. I think that actually many of the things we set out to do at the beginning about communicating, being relevant for the local area, providing broadcasting rather than narrow casting, not thinking of a typical listener, but really realizing we had a wide range of listeners, maintaining, I think, high standards in our journalism, and maybe I'm old-fashioned, but in the standards of our output, that's what I'm proud of. I'm proud of the fact we employ around 100 people, and I'm proud that it was all created from nothing. There isn't the opportunity for the entrepreneur anymore. And yeah, maybe entrepreneur is not the right word, because entrepreneur really means, you set it up and sell it on. And I wanted to do anything but. I wanted to set it up and carry on. I think it's really difficult to see how you could go from nothing to successful, durable organisation in radio now. Maybe DAB is changing that. Maybe somebody will come along with a brilliant idea for a format, will be able to find themselves carriage space and actually do something along those lines. But everything happening around us is towards consolidation. And I think the opportunity for building a long-term opportunity in the future is, it's just not the same as it was. Stereo Links FM. I don't seek the limelight. I'd like people to recognise from the success. My background from an education point of view was scientific rather than arts. You know, I spent most of my time with figures rather than writing. So lots of the experiences I had in the early age are counter, as you say, to being a media leader. I'm probably all those things in a very quiet way. But I do have a very clear vision of what's good, what sounds good, what makes good sales, what systems and dreams you need to have. Let's measure it another way. I really have to remember that this is work. It is, of course. There have been difficult times. There's been difficult decisions. There's have been times I've had to tell good people why they haven't got a job anymore. That's horrible. I hate it. But the overall, there are not many things I think, gosh, I wish I could be doing that rather than this. But most importantly, I hope I'm remembered for allowing a lot of young, inexperienced people to progress rapidly in the radio industry and to give them the opportunity of working in a way that's not too restrictive, for being consistent, for being visionary, for sometimes going in the opposite direction to everybody else, sometimes being right about that. I hope I'm also remembered by the people I've persuaded to invest in somebody with not an awful lot of experience at a very young age, that they did the right thing and that they've enjoyed their route in radio.